have broadened my presentation to try to include a wider range of issues than I would have initially. An outline of my presentation is shown here. I'm going to discuss several IPET resources. These include numerical modeling, as Ed has mentioned. Also, I was very impressed in working with Ed on IPET at the photographic resources. And this is both in Louisiana and Mississippi. I'll address some issues in Mississippi, where I've been working quite a bit lately. With the advent of the digital cameras and the plethora of video cameras, it's just amazing how much photographic documentation that is available. In Mississippi, for example, there are videos of houses floating and banging into other houses, et cetera, et cetera. And I hope all of this will be somehow collected in a central repository and preserved. I'd like to compare Katrina with some of the earlier storms, notably Camille, but others as well. And it turns out that Katrina was, as Ed has indicated, a major storm surge hurricane, but a much less wind hurricane. And I think that difference is quite striking. We'll look at some of the Katrina impacts in Mississippi. Again, the water effects there are amazing, and the benefits of elevation, as you might imagine, but there's a wide range of elevations along coastal Mississippi, and I've been working there a great deal lately, and it's really quite surprising how important elevation is. I'll talk a little bit about the wetland restoration. Henry mentioned the NRC committee that I was privileged to chair about 3 years ago now, although the committee tenure lasted about 4 years. And I'll mention some of the conclusions there, perhaps not literally as they came from the committee, but I'll try to capture the flavor of those. And then I'll summarize some of the lessons learned. Again, I'll start off with some of the photographic documentation. Ed has already showed this picture, but this kind of documentation is very valuable because there's nothing else that can match it. And here it shows a wave crest overtopping a levee at the Paris Road bridge there. Here's another indication of some of the photographic documentation. This is the base of a traffic light pole right here, and you can see the water rushing through the area. This is the 17th Street Canal breach, and the person that took this, this is a frame from a video. You can see the fire from one of the natural gas lines that had broken, and here we have the 17th Street Canal breach. Some of the quality of these photographs, of course, is not too great, but again, they're very unique and extremely valuable in documenting the times. I've looked at, I guess, 8 or 9 videos from Mississippi, and one of the surprising things is that even the storm chasers sometime forget to put on the timestamp. And if ever you're in a hurricane and do decide to take video, by all means turn on the timestamp, because that's about half of the value of the information. This is slightly after Katrina passed, but again, you can see the breach in 17th Street levee. Ed showed this as well. You can also see the debris that has piled up on the Lake Pontchartrain side of the bridge, bridge that crosses the levee on the Lake Pontchartrain side. And one of the other resources that I'll mention later, is a physical model of the 17th Street Canal, which was very valuable in attempting to determine the propagation of waves down in that canal, and some of those results are quite surprising. Finally, another view of the London Avenue Canal, and again, immediately after the hurricane passed, you can see the very extensive flooding that occurred there. Ed mentioned the numerical models. This is the ADCERC model grid with, I believe Ed said, some 2.3 million nodes. So you can see that in the area where a lot of detail is required, such as the Chandelier Islands here, the nodes are very close together. So this is a very valuable feature and allows the representation of the hydrodynamics, the storm surges and currents, to be represented quite well. I believe Ed showed, not this one, I'll show two of these. This is the peak of the storm surges at their peak in Mississippi. And I believe you can read those. They get up to 26 feet. We're going to look at that a little bit more in detail later. And these show the maximum storm surges. I believe the maximum right here, I believe it's 27 feet. And it's interesting, quite surprising, that the maximum storm surge in the Louisiana area is right up against the East Levee. It's about 20 feet. But again, the surge over in Mississippi is a great deal higher. And it appears, if you look at an animation of this, I should mention this work was done by Johannes Westerink at Notre Dame, and both he and Rick Ludick are co-developers of the ADCERC model. Rick is at the University of North Carolina. But if you look at the an animation of this, actually a wave appears to propagate in, a storm surge wave, and then actually reflect off the East Levee and coincide with the direct surge at Mississippi. I'll have a little bit more to say about that later. Again, one of the very valuable resources were the high water marks that were taken. There were on the order of 400 or 500 high water marks both in Louisiana and Mississippi, some of better quality than others. But here you can see in Louisiana, the agreement between the high water marks and the ADCERC predicted surge. So this is using winds that I'll mention a bit later to as input to the ADCERC model. It's interesting that, well, we've already seen that the peak storm surges in Mississippi were substantially higher than in Louisiana. And if we look at the high water marks here, the maximum, in Louisiana it's about 22 feet. And then if we look at the same type of a presentation for Mississippi, we see that the peak high water mark is about 28 feet. I think you'll recall that when we examined the predicted high water surge in Mississippi, it was about 27 feet. So they're reasonably good, maybe not exactly the same. One of the surprising aspects that has occurred to me is that portions of coastal Mississippi, if our understanding is correct, have been impacted by two 1,000-year storm surge events in a period of 36 years. That is Hurricane Camille that occurred in 1969 and then Katrina in 2005. We've tried to do some, well, you might ask the question, is that possible? Yeah, it's possible. Is it probable? No, it's not probable. But the probability is a little difficult to calculate. We've made some efforts to carry out that calculation, recognizing that this portion of Mississippi, which is around the Pass Christian area, is fairly short, might be 6 or 7 miles. So what is the probability of two 1,000-year storm surge events impacting the same area within a 36-year period? It's quite low, but we haven't really completed that calculation. One of the other resources or tools that was available or was used in the IPET study was the physical model study carried out at Waterways Experiment Station in Vicksburg of the 17th Street Canal. Here you can see the 17th Street Canal, the location of the breach, and so the 17th Street Canal is located, difficult to see on this slide perhaps, but it's located right here. Here you can see the wave makers that were used, and they allowed the waves to propagate to arrive from either the north or some angle relative to the north. And the propagation of the waves down the 17th canal can be investigated as shown here. In a slide where the adjacent area is flooded, so you can see waves propagating over the normally dry portions of the land, the area, and you can see the waves propagating down 17th Street Canal. And you can see how they get damped a great deal as they propagate down in the canal, and a much lesser wave height on the south side of the Robert E. Lee Bridge there. I'd like to spend a little bit of time looking at some of the effects of Katrina in Mississippi. We've already seen that in some of the relationships of the high water marks, et cetera. And I'll try to indicate something about the Saffir-Simpson scale. Ed mentioned that as well. First, let's look at chart of the path of Hurricane Katrina. And I'm not sure how well it shows there, but Ed mentioned also that for a portion of its transit, it was actually a Category 5. Very intense storm, a very large storm. We'll see how intense it was relative to other historic storms in a few minutes. But by the time it actually made two landfalls, one in Louisiana at Burris, and then one at about the Mississippi-Louisiana border. And, when it made landfall at the border, it was a Category 3. I've talked to some people who have actually turned off the winds in the numerical model when the storm was still about 70 miles offshore. And this was not ADCIRC, it was a simpler model. But it indicated that if you turned off all the winds when the hurricane was 70 miles offshore, the storm surge on the shore was still about two-thirds of what it would have been with the winds present. So there are a lot of things we don't understand about hurricanes and their effect and what the impact of time-varying wind fields is, but it looks like the Category 5 intensity out in the Gulf of Mexico, in a sense, predestined the very large storm surges, the unprecedented storm surges, which occurred along the Mississippi coast. As an illustration of the fact that the Saffir-Simpson scale doesn't work for all hurricanes, again, at landfall, Katrina was Category 3 based on wind speeds, but it was a Category 5 based on storm surges. Again, Saffir-Simpson scale indicates that anything above an 18-foot storm surge is Category 5. The Saffir scale was developed in 1974 by Herbert Saffir after Hurricane Camille for the United Nations, and then Simpson later added the storm surge aspect. So maybe these two have to be separated to be more useful for the community. Well, we've looked at this. We'll back up one. Much of the area that was impacted by the storm surges and the accompanying waves, the waves inside the barrier islands were about 6 to 8 feet in height, and they were about 8 second period. But those combination of unprecedented storm surge and reasonably high waves really devastated the Mississippi coast. This is an area where the storm surge was about at its maximum. And again, I've visited that area many times. I was there yesterday, as a matter of fact. And below the debris line, the houses and most of the structures were just completely gone. The area was just scoured clean, and the debris line represents roughly the limit of inundation of the storm surge. Actually, the storm surge inundation was a bit north of that area, but not too much. But again, the unprecedented storm surge and the large waves, again, which is well documented in many of the videos, is responsible for sweeping all of that debris from trees, but mostly constructed facilities, to the north. I know that there's a parallel study going on in Mississippi to that which is underway here in Louisiana to look at the possibility of levees there. That's being done by the Mobile District. And it turns out I've seen some of the preliminary layouts of those, and I believe they've been put forth a bit in public hearings. Most of the people are certainly not interested in levees in Mississippi. They're not used to them. And also the idea of a possible buyout has been presented. That also has met with not much interest at all. One of the additional types of data or resources that are available in Mississippi are the wind towers. And I cannot say enough for the wind towers or those that are responsible for placing them. The University of Florida has what they call a Florida Coastal Monitoring Program, in which they emplace wind towers. Also, Texas Tech emplaces wind towers. And I'll just talk a little bit about these three, but they were deployed within a day or probably within one day of landfall of Katrina. And of course, they try to emplace them where they'll measure the highest winds, but they're not always successful. This is at the Pascagoula Airport, Stennis International Airport, and Slidell Municipal Airport. This is one of the Texas Tower wind towers that is placed prior to Katrina. It has the anemometers located at the standard height of 10 meters, and they're well-calibrated instruments. The data are really very valuable to work with. Here's a set of the results. This is wind speed in green and wind direction in blue. These measurements are made every tenth of a second, and I'll show you some of those results later. But you can see that the drop in wind speed right as the hurricane went past. Again, this wind tower was in place within the zone of the eye of the hurricane, so it was a little bit toward the center of the hurricane from the radius of maximum winds. One of the other wind products that is available is that from the Hurricane Research Division of NOAA. These are the H-star winds at 10 o'clock Central Daylight Time. And you can see this is 85 knots, so the peak winds at landfall were about 90 knots. This slide shows the comparison between the 1 minute sustained winds from the wind towers. And the 1 minute sustained winds are the winds that are considered in the Saffir-Simpson scale, and also the IPET winds. It's interesting that the IPET winds are always higher at those locations, same locations, than the tower winds. It turns out that the tower winds were not always placed at what's called an open terrain, but as best they could. And I've done some calculations. It looks like these winds should be increased by about 15%. Some of the other wind products, these were developed by Applied Research Associates, are the 3-second wind speeds. Okay? And you can see that along the coast, they were at most 130 miles per hour. I think we're running a little short on time. I'll just mention that there's been a group out of Georgia Tech, led by Fritz, who made a post-Katrina reconnaissance study. And they determined, in part from the high water marks, the peak surges in Katrina. And here they are compared with Camille. I'm going to show a couple more of these. I'll skip over that. And we'll just look at these two slides. These are the coastal storm surges in Hurricane Katrina and other storms, starting from Grand Isle and going over to downtown Mobile. And you can see that in terms of storm surges, Katrina was a very special event, as we've been discussing. Much larger than Camille, and I'm not even sure about that point in Camille, but it may be correct. whereas the coastal winds in Katrina were not unusually large. Again, here is Katrina in black, and you can see that Camille was a much larger wind event than Katrina was. Another set of information from Camille from the Mobile District of the Corps, and you can see that the winds there were up to 175 miles per hour, category 5 when it made landfall. Now, the 175 is not the same as the maximum sustained winds, but still, if you do a one-to-one comparison, it was a major event. This is a report that we produced in our NRC study, and these are the predicted land losses, 14 square miles per year over the next 50 years. Hurricane Katrina and Rita together caused the loss of 200 square miles of wetland. I guess one point I'd like to bring out is the enormous size of this system. EdLink showed some of the subsidence rates, maybe 2 to 3 centimeters per year in this area. This is 12,000 square miles. You know, to think of trying to replumb the Mississippi over that large area is presents a real challenge, I believe. I think in the interest of time, I'll just show two more slides. This shows the natural system about 1850. And you can see that Mississippi was a very leaky conveyance. And that's what, in part, in addition to this large, much longer scale relocation of the main branch of the Mississippi, these are what maintain the wetlands. We've now tightened that up for many reasons, agriculture primarily, I suppose, navigation as well. But now most of the sediment and water, except for the Atchafalaya, are discharged through the three main tributaries of the Bird's Foot. So to try to revert back to this stage, I think, is going to be very challenging. Well, summarized with three points, we've learned a great deal as a result of Hurricane Katrina, but there's really a challenge to implement these lessons. The challenge comes in attempting to place instruments in the advance of the storm, and also to respond to the information that we've learned in terms of the hazards of living in very low elevation areas. Katrina was certainly an unprecedented storm surge event. And finally, the barriers to reversing wetland loss. I think we've discussed that earlier today. And I'd like to underscore the reversing here are probably insurmountable. I don't think we're going to be able to reverse the wetlands loss. And at least to my mind, I've tried to study this over the last maybe 10 years. I think one of the main resistors, if you will, are going to be the stakeholders. People, we have so many stakeholders that, as were mentioned by Mr. Jenkins, the oystermen, certainly the shipping industry, agricultural industry, and just the people that live where they live there. The land is sinking, it's subsiding in most places. But to ask those individuals to give up their land or their particular stake and way of life with regard to the Mississippi River, I think is going to be a daunting task. Thank you very much.